She gives me great and will I be great honor to introduce you, Nancy Emerald.
Well, thanks so much. And it's fun to be here in this context and sharing some ideas with you that I'm kind of in the midst of working with. And what I want to do really is invite you to just interrupt and provide your own commentary along the way. And what I want to do is talk to you about this work that I've been doing on lived religious practice, and start by telling you what I mean by that. What I'm looking at here is all the times and places where you see people doing something that involves a recognition of something more than ordinary. That is, we sometimes would call it sacred or transcendent or supernatural. There are all kinds of ways of describing that sense of connection to something that's not just ordinary, everyday reality. So I'm looking at all of those places where people are operating with that sensibility as part of what they're doing. And in most instances, what that means is that awareness of something beyond or something more does get talked about in terms of a divinity, of God, but not always. Most instances, it actually does have some connection to a religious tradition. You can actually see that what people are doing that involves their connection to something beyond themselves draws on ways that things that they've learned and language they've learned and practices they've learned as part of a religious tradition. Now, I was just saying you can't study these kinds of things without also noticing that they don't always stick really strictly to a religious tradition. People are often drawing on multiple sources for how they have a sense of connection with something beyond themselves. But that's the focus here. So the idea is, you know, where are all of the times and places and ways in which that kind of connection happens? And one of the things that my previous research has really pointed out is that this kind of lived religious practice can happen just about anywhere. It doesn't require you to be in church on Sunday for it to happen. That people have ways of connecting with something beyond themselves that can happen, obviously, in their family life, out in nature, at work, in all kinds of other times and places. But as I was saying before we got started, one of the things I also discovered is that having that kind of sensibility about what's going on in the world and how I'm interacting in the world is much more common if people also have conversation partners, if they have communities, if they have places where people are intentionally engaging in conversation about what it means to be religious or spiritual. So people carry that over with them then into their everyday lives. So what I want to do for these few minutes is explore with you some of how I'm thinking about what it means to actually look at somebody doing this thing, this lived religious practice thing. You know, what are we looking at? What are the dimensions, the aspects of the experience that we should be paying attention to? And what I'm doing is building on some really basic kind of social and phenomenological theory to talk about, you know, how we as human beings kind of move through life. What are the ways in which, what are the aspects of our experience in everyday life? And think about that in terms of what does that say to us about what we look for and what we notice when we're noticing people engaged in lived religious practice. So we'll take these one at a time. And what I'm going to do is just sort of describe a little bit of what I see when I think about this aspect of practice, and invite you to think about what you experience and where you've seen both yourself and other people engaged in religious practice, and how what you would notice if you were particularly noticing, in the first case, the embodied character of practice. That is, when we act in the world, your body's acting in the world. We have to take account of the fact that we see, we taste, we touch, we smell, we hear, we move in our interaction. So when we're engaged in doing something religious or spiritual, it is our bodies doing those things. And so when we pay attention to that, we often notice things about what's going on that we wouldn't notice if we didn't pay attention to the embodied nature. And one of the things that calls attention to, of course, is the fact that one of the places where people often turn to religious practice has to do with health and healing. As much as we may depend on the people at the hospital or the people in the doctor's office or whatever, we also often understand our bodies as having a connection to something beyond ourselves, and we call on that connection often, particularly when we're up against a problem. It's interesting that those kinds of experiences of coming up against the limits of our human capacities are places where we experience that connection to something beyond ourselves. But it's not just our embodied self, it's also the fact that we make things as human beings. We surround ourselves with material objects that are also very much a part of our practice. Whether it is the sort of the material objects you might find in a Catholic healing shrine in New Mexico, which is the picture on the bottom right, or a stave church in Norway, a church built 900 years ago out of all wood. And believe me, it's also a sensory experience when you go in it, because it has been preserved all these years with a sealant that has a wonderful pungent odor. So you come into the space and you not only experience the form of this space, but also the smell. But think about all of the other kinds of objects that we have that are part of how we understand what it is we're doing, whether it's lighting candles or, if you're Jewish, wearing a prayer shawl. In the olden days, Catholic women wore their little veils into church. Or a baseball cap that says, "Jesus is one way." One of the most interesting areas of research on lived religious practice is, in fact, the way it intersects with the market, with the things that people make, whether it's publishing industry or the knick-knack industry or the clothing industry or whatever, yoga pants, you name it, all of which are the material objects that we use to engage in our religious practice. But our engagement in the world is also emotional. And this is one of those things that people often try to sort of downplay. And the Protestants especially are known for being very solemn, Calvinists especially. It's all rational and no emotion. We just don't do that. But even that is a way of setting some boundaries and norms around emotions that says emotion is important, if nothing else, to keep it under control. But for many people, the expression of their religious experience is also an emotional expression, whether it's joy or affection that builds relationships, that, and it can also be fear or terror. Think about the kinds of rituals that sometimes are intended to scare the pants off of you. The whole range of emotion is something that we need to take into account as we're thinking about what it means to both to engage in religious practice and to think about studying it. I think music is a particularly interesting example here in the way it sort of combines a variety of these dimensions. Singing together is something that is an embodied experience. It's something that often evokes emotion. The next thing we're coming up on is aesthetics. It certainly has an aesthetic dimension. And it also has material dimensions often that, you need a pipe organ for certain kinds of music, and you have an orchestra, or you have a particular sound stage and sound equipment and all of that material sort of infrastructure that goes with producing certain kinds of music. And that, I think, the more we know about music as a lived practice, the more we know about how deeply it becomes a part of us, becomes something that we're not even really aware of why we respond the way we respond, but we do. Garrison Keillor was particularly wonderful at describing what happens when Lutherans sing together. And the kind of, from the time you're a kid sitting on your parents' lap in church and feeling the resonance of someone singing and hearing the harmonies and so forth, that becomes simply part of how you understand what it feels like to be in a religious experience. But that is also a part of this aesthetic dimension, that we often don't pay attention to the aesthetics. Probably Catholics do more than Protestants. Protestants have a hard time recognizing that even the most austere space is an aesthetic. The notion that one can only get in touch with something beyond oneself when you strip away everything. There are yoga practices in particular that are very strong on this, that you get into a little cell with no windows and white walls and no sound, and that's how you get in touch with something beyond yourself. But others, of course, are drawn to a kind of full immersion in sight and sound and so forth. And it's important to recognize that aesthetics are part of, that they're socially embedded, that we have different aesthetic sensibilities in part dependent on how we've grown up and where we're located in terms of social class, among other things. That, some people are going to be drawn to the sort of mega church, grand, lights and sounds and the kind of thing that they would also experience perhaps, at a big rock concert. That aesthetic is something that they find exciting and, something that pulls them in. Others are going to want the kind of austerity. Others are going to have, refinement. And what we understand to be refined is very much defined by our cultures and our social class. The Islamic aesthetic is another really distinct aesthetic, which this is a little piece of the Blue Mosque in Istanbul, with that non-representational art style. So when we think again about our experience of practicing religion, we often don't take that into account, but we need to. Now, what we do take into account often is that our religious practice is supposed to have moral consequences, right? It's supposed to make us a good person. And certainly, we should think about the how our practices embody the kind of person that we should be. I think one of the really interesting studies that does this is Saba Mahmood's study about Islamic piety in Cairo. She looks at women and how they're sort of teaching themselves to pray and to read the Quran and to dress in certain ways produces a certain sense of piety in them. It's not that they were pious and they decided to do these things, but doing the practices is a way that they become the kind of person that they want to be. And sometimes the moral dimension of our practice is explicit teaching, right? We go to Sunday school or confirmation class or whatever, and people teach us how to be a good person. And that's a practice too. So thinking about what kinds of practices do we engage in, some of which are very explicit and intentional, and some of which are much more about sort of observing the people around us and having models for, you know, who gets the award, you know, who gets lifted up as the exemplary person. Those are important ways in which our religious practices embody and teach and shape our way of being in terms of how we think about what's good and bad. Now, up to now, I think barely used the word spirituality. And most people who think about lived religious practice are likely to sort of use it interchangeably with spirituality. This is my spirituality, right? And what I want to argue is that that's probably cutting religion short, and also not really taking into account the spirituality itself, the multiple ways in which spirituality enters into this lived practice. That is, some kinds of lived religious practice really don't expect you to have a kind of transcendent moment. You know, you just show up and do it. They don't necessarily expect an individual experience of ecstasy or, you know, awe or joy or anything of the sort. They simply expect us to enact the kinds of rituals that are important to being a part of a religious community or to our own sense of who we are. But some lived religious practice does, in fact, involve and expect really dramatic spiritual encounters. They expect that you're going to sort of enter another world and speak in tongues and fall on the floor and do whirling dervish and all things that are quite out of the ordinary. So paying attention to that spiritual dimension of the practice allows us to see how varied that experience actually is for people, and to see how it's related to all these other dimensions of religious practice. And finally, words. Words do matter. And I think it's that it's most useful to think about words as forming stories. And I've written a good bit about this, to even think about the things that we think of as our doctrines or our theologies as stories about the way the world is, the way the world ought to be, what God has done in the world, and so forth. But not everybody it's not just the official theologians who get to tell stories like that. You know, the rest of us tell stories about what's happening with God and us in the world. Those are often called testimonies. We tell stories about our lives that include our understanding of what our relationship is to our religious traditions, to our spiritual experiences, and so forth. And one of the reasons that I like thinking about the importance of the narrative dimension of practice is that when we tell these stories, they embody both our memories, our sort of links to, you know, this is who we are, these are the stories we tell about ourselves, but also the way that can be a source of imagination. That when we are telling a story, there's always a kind of openness to that story. It can unfold in lots of different ways. You know, a story is never really told the same way twice. So we're both drawing on what we remember, what we know as we tell stories, but also what we imagine could be. So let's sum up. I'm saying when we think about our lived religious practice, whether we're studying it or thinking about our own, we should be paying attention to all these dimensions all at once. That any given thing we do that we think of as a religious practice is embodied, does have material dimensions, is emotional, has an aesthetic dimension, is teaching us something about morality, is spiritual in one way or another, and is expressed in stories. And that, like all kinds of social practice, religious practices have both a kind of structure, a kind of habit, that is, we do the things we already know to do, we often do them quite automatically without even really thinking, and they can be creative as we intentionally think about how do we respond to a given situation and how are we going to move forward in that situation. I'm also just reminding us that sometimes there is an intense individual experiential thing going on, and sometimes we are, again, habitually enacting practices. And that these are things that happen across institutional boundaries, that they can show up almost anywhere. So let me invite you to think about your own experiences and what you've observed, and you know, where do these things ring true? How would you think about the embodied and material and aesthetic and all of the rest?
Thank you. You're looking at the General Religion Survey or the Pew Trust thing. It's kind of if you're an institutionally defined person, mm-hmm. Catholics used to be institutionally defined, seemingly not so much anymore. But like the largest religious grouping is evangelicals, followed by, I think, by Catholic, and then as you point out, probably by nuns, mm-hmm. followed by former Catholics. So nuns is the third largest grouping, and former Catholics are the fourth largest. Now, among the groups that do not hear smart questions are the American Catholic bishops. They're famous for not hearing smart questions. Okay. They're concerned. They're always raising the question, why don't people go to Mass?
Yeah.
You know, which I kind of think is the wrong question. Mm. I think that's starting from the wrong place and going there. You know, I taught the freshman theology course last year, which was not a body experience. You want to go to a body. And my experience is, and Monica was in this, so maybe she wants to testify later. But my thing is that clearly these young people are finding transcendent meaning elsewhere than in the church. How would you phrase that in a way that an American Catholic bishop famously, mm-hmm. I used to say about the bishops, the ears are purely decorative and they don't really hear anything. how would you say it in a way that they could hear, but they're, rather than saying, why don't BC undergraduates go to church?
Yeah. So I would say these are people who are not uninterested in what you have to say, Bishop, about the meaning of life and why why we're connected to something larger than ourselves, some tradition that has something to say to us. And they need to have a community in which they can talk about that. And maybe they don't go to Mass, because at Mass, all that's happening is somebody is talking to them, instead of them having an opportunity to talk to each other.
Hmm. I'll call Cardinal O'Malley today and ask him to have a conversation.
Okay. Right.
Yes, I can.
I have a few questions. So it strikes me that you seem to have made a very strong distinction between religion and spirituality. Is that really helpful or necessary? And then when you use the term spirituality, you define it in terms of what maybe one would designate as mysticism more than mm-hmm. spirituality, that can encompass all kinds of dimensions of mm-hmm. religion. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that dichotomy is so helpful or necessary. So
I tried desperately actually not to make a dichotomy out of this. I've actually written an article on the spiritual but not religious question mark, and pushing very hard in my field not for people not to set up a binary. If you're either religious or you're spiritual. Sociologists are very fond of asking, are you religious, are you spiritual, are you both, are you neither? Or asking two questions and then putting people in a 2x2 table. I think that's really the wrong way to go at it. And what I'm trying to do here is to say that spirituality should be thought of as one of the dimensions of lived religious practice. And that as such, it varies enormously. Mm-hmm. So people can be engaged in religious practice that has very different spiritual content or intensity or whatever.
Okay, so but it always has spiritual content then?
Well, I would say that it doesn't necessarily always have individually experienced spiritual,
I wonder if that's helpful, because when you're using the term spirituality in that sense, it's a very particular way of understanding it, more out of, as you were saying, out of body experience, or an experience that's so unusual. But whereas mm-hmm. there's a whole continuum of mm-hmm. of spiritual experiences mm-hmm. that are part of religion, mm-hmm. and by making that distinction, I don't know if that's so helpful. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about why in that article you didn't want to make that distinction between spirituality and religion. What was your argument there?
I was working from the data from the Spiritual Narratives in Everyday Life project, and one of the things we did was analyze how people told us stories about their everyday lives, looking for how they defined spirituality. We didn't supply a definition. So we looked for how they identified something as spiritual, how they talked about it, and then where it showed up, what kinds of things they attached that label to. And so what I was doing was both identifying a range of kinds of definitions, how people identified what constituted spirituality, and then pointing out the degree to which the people who used a spiritual but not religious label for themselves actually were neither, in that they were very unlikely to see any aspect of their lives in spiritual terms. And they also were not engaged in any kind of religious, organized religious practice. Mm-hmm. But what they were doing was engaging in a way of talking about themselves that allowed them to be seen as a nice, normal person in the context in which they now were located, So I talk about that kind of discourse as a boundary maintenance mechanism. It's a way of saying, oh, I'm not one of those religious fanatics, but I'm a nice person, I'm spiritual. So that was part of the argument. Part of it was simply to say that that cell, that spiritual but not religious cell, is actually pretty empty. If you look at the what's actually going on and not the discourse about mm-hmm. what's going on. Mm-hmm. But the question of how to talk about spirituality is a hugely fraught question, both theoretically and in terms of just how people in the culture talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for being here today. I'm curious about intentionality in your way of thinking and in your the presentation you made today. Is there anybody who doesn't experience religious practice in their lives at all in the categories that you're saying? And are the people that you're describing as having religious practices in all these categories, must they be intentional about it in order for you to categorize them as such? So they might not know in your system that they're being religious, but they are being religious according to you. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you say a bit more about
that? So this is the, to use the scholarly term, the difference between an emic definition and an edic definition. Sometimes you want to use the category or the definition that the people involved use. So if they think they're being religious, I'm going to study what they're doing. If they think they're being spiritual, I'm going to study what they're doing. But I'm also attempting to look for certain kinds of phenomenological commonalities, so that if somebody's doing something that looks like that, even if they don't name it as such, I'm going to put it in that category. But I think, so talking about practice means that I'm going to back up. I'm using the term practice and the theory of practice that comes out of social theory and not out of theology. Okay, so theologians are going to talk about a practice in sort of Augustinian terms, I guess. Something that one intentionally engages in order to pursue this kind of formation of the self. Sociologists think that practices form the self too. We just think we do a lot of things that we don't intentionally set out to do. That when we come into a room like this, for instance, there are practices of speaking and listening, practices of eating and drinking, practices of how we array ourselves around the table, that I venture to say, you thought about maybe that long when you came in the room, because you already know how to do this, right? And yet we're enacting these things in ways that come out of our social class positions, out of our institutional experience in a higher education, out of all kinds of structures that have formed who we are and how we interact. There is this forming function that practices have, but they don't necessarily all have intentionality to them.
Okay.
Back in the corner.
Yeah, hello, my name is Thomas.
Yes.
Why don't you describe the project you're here doing?
Okay, yeah. Maybe I ask my question first and then I'll do it later. Okay, I think it's a great concept and it really gets what it's about in the religions. But there's just one thought that popped up in my head and I just want to know if you already thought about it. The way I see it is like you were doing the research about what we maybe call more or less like an official religion. Somebody believing in God, life after death, something like this. But I think you can also adapt this model which you created to some kind of unofficial religions.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah, like the civic religion, for example, people love their country, they have a spiritual connection to mm-hmm. their country, they sing their anthem very emotionally,
mm-hmm.
or also for things like health or wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are so much into health, you know, they go to the gym every day, they do meditation, I don't know. It's already a kind of religion to some
mm-hmm.
extent. And I think all, or at least nearly all of the points
mm-hmm.
you mentioned
mm-hmm.
could also adapt
mm-hmm.
for this one. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, in fact, that's exactly the door through which
mm-hmm.
I come, is to say, yes, a lot of it is shaped by particular religious traditions,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of it is mix and match and inventive and more creative.
Yes, it's
yeah.
The general topic, lived religious practice, it reminds me of the emphasis being given to what we call a new evangelization in the Catholic Church, especially the area where when Pope Paul VI wrote his rather famous letter on a new evangelization. There's a section there where he says that modern people listen more willingly to witnesses than to teachers. And when they do listen to teachers, it's because they are witnesses. So that emphasis on doing something to show that you've got some background in the religious, even the idea of what Pope Francis telling young people, get out into the streets and do something to show that you really mean it. So would you agree generally that that's a connection?
I think both the doing and the witnessing, if you will, are absolutely central to how people really become spiritual persons, religious persons. You know, we become that kind of person because we engage in activities that embody it, and in conversation with people who help us interpret what it is we're doing in light of that. So, you know, one of the other things I might say to the bishops is, you know, these are folks, these millennials or Gen X's or Gen Z's or whatever, you know, these are people who want to do something that makes a difference, right? So let's organize and offer them opportunities to do that, but let's also, in the process, tell the stories about how doing this has been part of our tradition, was taught to us by Jesus. You know, however you tell those stories, so that people come to see that this isn't something disconnected from a rich tradition that comes from the faith.
Yeah. Thanks so much for this presentation. I have questions about the idea around transcendence. I guess there's kind of two. So you mentioned signals of transcendence. Just kind of maybe a clarifying question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean, is that supposed to indicate that when you see a so-called signal of transcendence, that's marking a spot where transcendence happens, or that signal somehow like sparks a personal transcendent experience?
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is, what exactly is ordinary transcendence? Because it seems to me that transcendence by nature is
not ordinary.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was using that in that particular slide to say that a lot of people, I think, talk about spirituality as simply being in a state of peace, quiet, you know, not anything that really disconnects them from whatever else they're experiencing, but sort of adds a dimension, if you will, to that moment. It's a moment of that's special in some way. That was the ordinariness that I was trying to capture there, as in some sense kind of the baseline, if you will, of that spiritual continuum, that, you know, at another end of that spiritual continuum, one is quite not in touch, at least consciously, with what's going on around you and so forth. So,
okay.
Yeah. was the other person?
Just signals of transcendence.
Signals, yes. That's actually a term that Peter Berger used to talk about laughter, among other things. That there are things that we see and hear that trigger for us a memory or an experience of something that is transcendent. For me, one of the things that I think of that just sort of viscerally does that is listening to a full peal of church bells. It'll just sort of waves over my body.
Thank you.
Well, I want to ask you about where conversions play in this picture. And I'm thinking not just about intellectual conversions, maybe somebody felt like one tradition had more truth claims, or even aesthetic conversions, maybe they thought this is better music, or I like the pop, I like the rock band feel more than you know, my parents' small Baptist church. But also unintentional, kind of going back to what Eric was asking, unintentional conversions, like you raise your kids, but you only take them to church a couple times a year, and then they get into high school and everybody's lifting weights, and that becomes three times a week. You know, so I guess I wanted to know, like, how do you talk much about conversions? And
I don't talk about conversion a lot, but I think one of the things that this kind of model of lived religious practice offers to the understanding of conversion is that it's a conversion that really shapes a redirection of a person's life is likely to be multidimensional and to involve ongoing practices and ongoing conversations. So when a person is converted, part of what that means is an alteration in the significant conversations that are going on in their lives. You know, so who are we talking to and what are we talking about? But it also involves being adopting new practices. And here's where the intentionality is likely to be there. And when people are in the process of conversion, they're very aware of everything they're doing. You know, everything becomes a question. Everything is new. So people are making really intentional links between, because I believe this, I should be doing that. Or because I'm in this community, I'm expected to act in this way. So the sort of the habit piece is all getting thrown up in the air.
Right.
Now, a sociologist named Ann Swidler wrote a really influential article about culture about 30 years ago, in which she talks about how culture most of the time is present for us in those habits, in just in the way things we assume are going to be. But when we encounter a situation that unsettles those assumptions, that where something doesn't fit, we have to stop and ask ourselves, why am I doing this? And so the idea part of culture comes into play when there are those ruptures. But one of the things she points out in that article is that whole apparatus of habit is really powerful, and that attempts to change, really fundamentally change a culture or a person, always come up against that really well-embedded structure of habit. I mean, ask anybody who is a recovering alcoholic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of thing we're talking about here, that you have to be really constantly intentional. So one of the things I'm trying to take account of is that sort of interplay between the stuff that just happens automatically and how you know, religious practice is often that, and the stuff that's creative and intentional and, you know, happening around the edges and so forth.
I wanted to also ask about community. You said that that's an essential or necessary part of lived religion.
Mm-hmm.
But then is that not in contradiction with what you, with the kind of bricolage religiosity that...
Oh, not at all. I think partly because one of the things I'm really pushing toward is for people to think of religion as not a thing, but rather to really focus on the practices themselves and say, okay, you know, here's somebody doing something that is a religious practice. And they can be in conversation with lots of different people about their religious practices. And
so it's not one community. It's
so
just
it's,
sort of
it
one
can
is...
be multiple communities. So they're not likely to maintain any given practice without a community that sees that as a normal, beneficial, good thing to do.
And that's where I think the contradiction lies of that kind of religiosity, of lived religion.
Mm-hmm.
So they draw from communities, but they don't build community, or they don't contribute to the communities that they draw from.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the problem
yeah.
in terms of that type of...
The people who think of themselves as spiritual but not religious
mm-hmm.
are precisely in that category. And I'm both optimistic and pessimistic about that. I'll tell you the pessimistic side first. I just spent the weekend with a whole bunch of people talking about what spirituality is, so forgive me. But one of the most striking projects was one looking at the African American religious practice, and the particularly looking at the people who are dropping out, who are now the African American nuns. And what you see is that they are much less likely to vote, to be civically engaged, to understand the structural dimensions of racism, sort of all of the things that the Black church has traditionally provided for the African American community, that these people are losing that. So that's the pessimistic side of me, that you know, these are people who've got the resources to engage in their own, you know, individual spiritual practice. They may still believe in God, they may still pray, but they don't have those critical tools. The more optimistic side of me hangs out with a guy named Casper Tocqueville over at Harvard, who, along with Angie Thurston, has been running a variety of projects. The first of which was titled How We Gather, and they're continuing to basically to look at, you know, the people you were talking about, the people who are interested in developing their spiritual lives, but they're gathering in lots of different ways, dinner church, soul cycle, you know, all kinds of things. And what Casper and Angie are trying to do is to see what the emergent forms of community are. And they're very committed to the notion that those emergent forms of community need to matter, you know, need to make a difference in the larger community, that they need to have a social justice kind of a component to them. So, you know, they're looking for where people who are, you know, thinking spiritually and don't want to go to mass, you know, are somehow actually gathering in communities and trying to do this kind of serious community formation. Whether they'll succeed or not, I don't know.
But when you say need to, is that sort of a normative statement based on what is ethically commendable or what is going to mean the longevity of the community? Where does that normative element come from?
The need to
have an ethical dimension,
yeah,
or have
make
a
difference.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a normative statement.
But based on what?
Based on my own normative commitments and theological commitments.
Okay, so Christian
yeah.
based, but that's not what informs those groups. So
not always. Yeah, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
The statement that they need to gather in order to nurture the spirituality, that's a sociological fact.
Okay, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm actually doing a project right now where I visit Catholic parishes who are known to be very good in integrating and welcoming people.
Mm-hmm.
And more or less everything which you said you can find in this, what I call arrival parishes, that are very good in doing this job.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the embodiment point which you have. Mm-hmm. These parishes come up with all kind of different new rituals.
Mm-hmm.
So they create their own rituals to kind of convey their faith, you know, to embody their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very strong on the aspects of solidarity and engagement for the poor. It's
mm-hmm.
like also the moral aspect which
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
had. Or the community is also very strong. They're setting up the chairs in the church before Mass.
Mm-hmm.
They organize like a coffee hour afterwards
mm-hmm.
where everybody brings a cake. Yeah. Like
yes.
all these
yes.
points
yeah.
which you more or less answered,
yeah.
you can actually see in the research
yeah.
which I'm doing.
Yeah.
So it's actually kind of a proof.
Yeah.
Yeah, like
yeah.
for everything.
Yeah, I think if you were a parish leader and wanted to engage people mm-hmm. fully, you would pay attention to all these dimensions. Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. You were trying to get in.
Oh, I'm interested in, I'm taking a college student development course right now, so I'm interested specifically in like the traditional college aged 18 to 24, but
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about the question you asked about conversion. So there's so many students, and we know from like the Aston and Aston study and all sorts that like 81% of students coming into college would say, I'm interested in matters of spirituality, but fewer than that would say I'm religious. And that has a lot to do with their developmental stage.
Yeah.
But for those who might be growing up without those habits that you talked about, but they're
mm-hmm.
interested,
mm-hmm.
What, and then also I was thinking about the spiritual and religious definitions, at least in what I was most recently reading. Spiritual identity tends to be an individual identity, so young people at least gravitate towards identifying as spiritual because then nobody else can speak on their behalf. But religious is inherently committed to a community. So I'm thinking about two things. Where would you encourage them among all these aspects to start exploring? And then to go off of Catherine's question, I think in order for it to be sustainable, do need to find communities, and they would have some sort of ideological commitment, and whether or not it's a Christian commitment, but there would have to be something that would keep them there. So where would you encourage, if you're working with college students, where would you push them? What would you?
Yeah. One of the important things that you said is that a lot of college students now don't have any sort of religious upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know the stories, they don't know the rituals, they don't know the moral precepts, they don't know any of this.
Right.
seriously. And one of the things that they experience on many college campuses is that the normative way to describe oneself is spiritual but not religious.
Right.
You don't want to say you're a religious person because everybody will think you're, don't invite her to the party. So they're being normed, they're being formed as they come into the college campus. So, where would I start? I think you could start almost anywhere. For some people, it's going to be, starting through art or music.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it's going to be starting through through justice engagement.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it's going to be starting through exploring ethics and morality really digging into the tough questions and
mm-hmm.
thinking about, all that hard stuff. In each case, I think the person who wants to be the chaplain or the former of these people, one of the keys is going to be being able to tell stories that link what they're exploring, their artistic exploration or whatever, with the larger traditions. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, here's Doctrine 101. It means, you know, here's a story about saint, or a story about, you know, something from the Bible, or an experience from the parish, or something that Cesar Chavez from the Easter Lenten pilgrimage for the farm workers. You know, there are all kinds of ways that those kinds of stories can be formative for people in linking, oh, that's what a religious tradition might have to offer me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
Thank you.
You got time for...
Do we have time?
Yeah, one more.
Yeah.
One of those stories last week on campus here, you may have heard of it. We had a speaker, Ray Hinton, his name was. He spent 30 years on death row, and he's going around now opposing the death penalty, and he wrote a book on it. Well, I go to a lot of these lectures, but there were several hundred young people there, and boy, they listened to him. And he tried to show how his religious background led him to the point where we shouldn't be killing people with the state. And he spent 30 years, apparently, hating for a while, and then trying to convert to loving his enemies, so that, I mean, it was an example of how it seems to work with someone, a witness like him.
Yeah.
And young people listen to him, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Stories can be really powerful.
Will you join me in thanking Nancy?